You know, we, with the tape ministry that we have here to Dot Mashiach, since we rarely do topical studies, sometimes it's a little difficult for people to know what material is covered on what tapes. And sometimes I've been asked to, to maybe provide some kind of a title or some kind of a handle, an information handle on what is going to be talked about or addressed in any particular individual tape. If we were going to call this morning's we would have to talk about it in terms of the decision that Esther made, the decision that she was required to make. I guess I would title it Esther's Dilemma, if it was to be called anything. Let's look at chapter 1, though, and go through some of this material quickly, and then we'll come back to this dilemma in chapter 4. It first of all begins with the words in verse 1. Now, it came to pass in these days of Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerus, Xerxes, the king who reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king sat on his throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all the princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. The king basically threw a party with the express intention of displaying his wealth and his grandeur and his glory. He wanted everybody within the provinces, within the 127 provinces, I guess, to have an idea of who was running things and perhaps the basis upon which things filtered down from Shushan into the provinces. I mean, in Shushan at the palace, things were grand on a remarkable scale. And he brought all of the princes and all of the leaders from each of these provinces to a kind of a bash or a party at his place, with the express intention of showing these people his power and his might and his grandeur and his glory. And he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom to them and the honor of his excellent majesty unto them in verse 4. And it even uses these words. His kingdom is described as glorious and his majesty is described as excellent for many days. Except it's important to see that celebration lasted up until this time for 180 days. I mean, they just didn't gather over at their house one afternoon for a little, for a few noshes. I mean, they gathered at the palace, including putting all of these people up and all the provisions that were necessary. Can you imagine feeding and banqueting these people for 6 full months? That's a long time. When these days were fulfilled, the king who made a feast unto the people and all of those who were present at Shushan, and it describes some of the things that were going on there, he decided at the end of this period of time, he had been banqueting with the princes and his wife Vashti had been banqueting with the women. He decided at this point in verse 11 to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal, to show the people and the princes her beauty, because she was fair to look upon. So after 6 months, he has shown these people the wealth of his kingdom, and now it's like he brings out his crowning glory here. He wants to show these people how beautiful his wife is, how beautiful is the queen. But the queen, Vashti, refused to come at the king's command by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king enraged, and his anger burned within him. Now, if you read carefully chapter 1, you'll see that there was a lot of wine that flowed during this banquet, and there was a lot of merriment and a lot of celebrating that went on, and people probably weren't thinking as clearly as they should have been by the end of 6 full months of this. Vashti was called out so that she could basically be paraded in front of these people, and she refused to come. The king got angry and then counseled with his ruling council, the people who helped him make wise decisions, and they decided that the queen should be deposed for her insolence. And so she is deposed, and a successor is sought, which is the subject of chapter 2. In verse 3 it said, "The king would appoint officers in all of the provinces of his kingdoms, that they may gather together all of the fair young virgins into Shushan, the palace, to the house of the woman, and brought to the custody of Haggai, the king's chamberlain." So there was a royal decree that went out, and this is an important point. There was a royal decree that went out from the king himself. And the decree was that all of the young virgins should be gathered together from each of the 127 provinces, and all of these women should be gathered to the palace in Shushan. Now, what's important about this is that there wasn't any kind of a... they didn't, have the kind of a news report on the Eyewitness News and say, you know, we're going to have a beauty pageant here. You know, if you think you can make the grade, then, you know, we've got a lot of these wonderful prizes in store for you. So if you want to get in on this contest, then come to Shushan, and if you're the lucky winner, then you'll get a 2-week paid holiday to Hawaii and a car and all of these kinds of things. They didn't handle the contest like that. You know what it says here? That every single virgin, every single one in the kingdom, every virgin that was eligible for marriage was to be brought to the palace here at Shushan. And then later on in chapter 2, by the time we get down to verse 8, we see that this mechanism, which has been ordered by the king, is already being put into place, and the women are being gathered now to the palace. What about a girl who didn't want to go to the palace to participate in the contest? What could she do about it? Nothing. The virgins aren't the ones who made the decision whether they would be included in this contest or not. The king is the one who decided. The king would be the one who decided which of the women he would select to be the next queen. But they were all required to participate. So it came to pass when the king's commandment came and his decree were heard, and when many maidens were gathered together, and this gathering of together of the maidens began, that these women were brought to the palace to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was also brought to the king's house to the custody of Haggai, the keeper of the women. And the maidens pleased him, and she obtained kindness. The maiden Esther pleased Haggai, and she obtained kindness from him, and he speedily gave her ointments for beautification with such things as belonged to her, and seven maidens, and so this process of beautification began, not only for her, but for everyone. Now, while this was going on, and all of these women are being collected together and gathered together, there's something else that's going on, too. What else is going on has to do with the fact that this particular girl happens to be a Jewish refugee. She happens to be in Shushan because she was a part of a people that were dispersed from the land of Israel. So she's not really there by choice. She's there in Persia or in Shushan because she was a part of a captivity. Now, her family was also a part of that captivity, and they came too. But by the time that this contest takes place, Esther's parents had died, and she was now being raised by her uncle, whose name was Mordechai. And it says in verse 10 that Mordechai had charged Esther not to reveal who her people were or who her kindred were, because Mordechai had charged her not to make that known. The other thing that's important has to do with who Esther is. Because her name, I realize that she's called Esther, but her name was not Esther. Her name was Hadassah. Her Hebrew name is Hadassah. As a matter of fact, the word Esther is a common name. It's very common in the English language as well, from other words that we have in English, which mean the same thing or are taken from the same root. The word Esther is taken from the same word that the word Easter is taken from. And Easter is taken from the word Ashtart, which is the name of the goddess of fertility, the Greek and Roman goddess of beauty and fertility. It should give us some idea of how beautiful this woman was, that she was named. I mean, she was named after the goddess of beauty. She was named after this pagan goddess of beauty. And so her name has been preserved to us as Esther. But her Hebrew name, which is the name which really signifies her character, her Hebrew name is Hadassah. At any rate, even in verse 10, we already get a glimpse of the conflict that's brewing here. Because how was this girl raised? How was Hadassah raised? Not only by her parents, but how was she raised as a Jewish girl, as a young Jewish girl who was raised and living in Persia? How was she raised? Was she raised as a Persian, or was she raised as a Jew? How would you expect her to have been raised? Yeah, she was raised as a Jew. Mordecai didn't call her Esther. You can count on the fact that Mordecai and everybody else who knew who this girl really was called her Hadassah. And what kind of a Jewish person was Mordecai? I mean, we know quite a bit about this individual from this account here. We know that he was an observant Jew. We know that his Jewishness was something which was important to him. We know that when he was called to compromise his relationship with the Lord, when he was called to compromise what he was as a Jew, in contrast to what Haman was as a Persian, that he wouldn't do it. And we can expect that he tried to bring up Hadassah to have that same kind of faith and that same kind of character about her too. Except you've probably discovered by now, if you have children and even if you don't, that not only is it difficult for us not to compromise generally, it's even more difficult to instill that desire to be steadfast and to be firm and to be committed in our children. I mean, it requires a lot of work to bring up our children not to compromise with the world, to bring up our children to be steadfast. That's the task that Mordecai had passed to him when Hadassah's parents died. At any rate, when Hadassah was taken by the men and taken to the palace, why do you suppose that Mordecai said, "Hadassah, when you get there, don't tell them that you're Jewish. Don't tell them that you're a part of a people that's been brought out of Israel in captivity." And you see what's going on here? I mean, they had no choice in what was going on. I mean, Mordecai, had Mordecai been able to, he probably would have refused to allow Hadassah to participate in this whole process. The point was is that he had no choice in this matter. She was an eligible young virgin. The king determined that all eligible young virgins were going to come, and she went. And Mordecai had no choice, and Hadassah had no choice. And so Mordecai counsels her to hide the fact that you're Jewish. Now, why do you suppose he instructed her to do that? Why do you suppose he instructed her to hide the fact that she was Jewish? And the fact that he even says that indicates that there was something about Hadassah that needed hiding. I mean, if Hadassah had been a completely assimilated Persian girl, and he wouldn't have had to warn her not to hide who she was. You know what I mean? If she was Persian, if her character was Persian, if she was Persian in her thinking, and Persian in her character, and Persian in her upbringing, there wouldn't be anything about her to hide. You know, I've known Jewish people who were raised in this country, and you know, they didn't know that they were Jewish. And when they went to a function, when they went somewhere where Jewish people were getting a little heat for something, you know something? They didn't feel hot. They didn't feel hot because they didn't know that they were Jewish. They didn't know that there was any reason to feel hot over. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, they, in some cases, were so assimilated. I know people that were so assimilated, the family names were changed, they were given all non-Hebrew names, they hadn't the foggiest idea that they were Jewish. Some of those people discovered it, and they stumbled across it. And then, you know, something began to happen within their heart and within their spirit. But this girl was a girl who was raised to be a Jewish girl. And Mordecai tells her, "Now, when you get to the palace, don't let anybody know. Why? Why did he say that? Was he afraid of what might happen to her? Was he afraid of what might happen to Hadassah? He had good reason to be. He had good reason to be afraid of what might happen there. Reg, you have an insight on that? That's right. That's a good observation. She was Jewish. She was being put into a position where she was going to be required, at least by in terms of the legal requirements of the Mosaic Law, to compromise what she was. She was going to be required to compromise her faith and her fact, and she was going to be required to basically compromise and to kind of do something which it really wasn't acceptable to do. I mean, what prospect was there for her? Here she is, a Jewish girl, you know, I mean, she's a beautiful girl. Everybody knew that she was a beautiful girl. You know, I mean, the whole object of it is, I mean, eventually, you know, this is one of those contests where, you know, the prize for winning isn't actually the kind of prize you want for your children. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, it's one thing to want your children to succeed at something. But to win this prize means that something is going to happen that you don't want them to win. You know, so it's like you're kind of rooting that maybe they won't be the one chosen. Of course, Mordechai was a faithful man. He was a believer, and he was sensitive to things of the Spirit. He told her how to hide her identity, and yet we're going to see that Mordechai ultimately comes to the place where he sees that what is happening because it's being manipulated by the hand of God in the background. And something remarkable is going to take place. And Mordechai ultimately comes to the place where he senses in his heart and in his spirit that God is the one who has orchestrated this entire procedure to see to it that something which is still, you know, something which has not yet happened is going to happen. And Esther is going to be put into a position where she can directly affect the outcome. Now, I must admit that this method seems a bit unorthodox to us. Except, again, if you are familiar not only with the way God works in the Scripture, but the way He works in our own lives, we frequently find that God often chooses methods and means that, you know, are way beyond our comprehension. And what is really special about the Lord, and this is the thing which to me is the most remarkable of His characteristics, is His ability to, in advance, basically provide a mechanism to thwart the efforts of the enemy even before those efforts are undertaken. I mean, that is a remarkable characteristic. Now, of course, that has no meaning for us today because there is no such thing as Satan and God is off on a vacation somewhere, and we don't ever get into these kinds of circumstances anyway. I mean, we are never put into a position where our faith is challenged, or we have to determine whether we should or should not do something. Or, obviously, I'm being facetious. Something that you can know to be true about God, and this is an important characteristic of God. Something that you have to know that is true about Him. The Scripture says that God doesn't miss anything. He doesn't miss anything. It doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference right now, at this very moment. It doesn't make any difference how you feel about the set of circumstances that you're facing, whether you're unemployed or employed, whether you love your job or whether you hate it, whether you're facing a difficult set of circumstances or you're not. I mean, you know, if you're not in something, if you're not facing difficulty now, just hang on for a few days or a few weeks. I mean, you will be. I mean, it's like a guarantee. And I'm not saying, gee, you know, all we have to look forward to is tsuris, you know, these problems and conflicts and messes for the rest of our lives. But yeah, well, yeah. Now, I'm not saying impending doom, kind of. You know, like, but we do all face difficulties. And isn't it good to know, whether we believe it or not, but isn't it good to know, and we should believe it, isn't it good to know, isn't it important to know, maybe Maybe it's something that we should know more in our heart. We need to know this more in our heart. Unfortunately, we don't even know it so well in our head. But isn't it good to know that the Lord knows all of the circumstances you face, not only the ones you're facing now, but the ones you're going to face in 2 days, or in 2 weeks, or in 10 years, or in 20 years? Isn't it important to you that you are important enough to God? You are important enough to God that He is already beginning to seed the mechanism by which you can be freed. He's already beginning to seed the experiences in your life. He is already laying the foundation in your life, in the lives of others around you, and in the experiences you are having right now, today, this evening, in the next few weeks, that will impact decisions that you have to make years from now. Now, He goes to a lot of trouble for you. Why does He do that? Because He loves us. And you will never face anything that will challenge that truth. You will never, ever face or experience anything that can compromise God's love for you and the care with which he works in your life. When you're facing a difficult situation, God doesn't come through with the answer at the last minute to save you or to give you wisdom or to work in whatever situation you're facing. I mean, God has been working behind the scenes, and what's unfortunate about it is that we rarely see those things. We rarely see the effort He puts into us. And we don't see that effort because our perspective is not like His is. Our perspective is not like His is. We should have the kind of perspective He does. Unfortunately, we don't. She was told to hide her identity, and then she was taken away to be beautified for the 12 months worth of beautifying. Okay? In chapter 2, later on in the chapter, it says that Esther was taken into the king's house in verse 16. She was loved by the king above the other women. She obtained grace and favor in his sight. And the royal crown was placed upon her head in verse 17. And she was made queen in the place of Vashti. She was made queen in the place of Vashti. And then in verse 18, this king really liked to party. He made a great feast again unto all the princes and his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release from taxes to the provinces, and he gave gifts according to the bounty of the king. I mean, he really celebrated the fact that a new queen had been selected. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai, because he was Hadassah's uncle, he was given a place of responsibility as well. And in those days, in verse 21, Mordecai sat in the king's gate. I wonder if you'd look real quickly up at verse 2 of chapter 3. And all the king's servants who were in the king's gate bowed and did obeisance to Haman. Now we have the introduction of Haman, a man who was elevated, obviously, quite a bit more quickly than he should have been, and he was given far more responsibility within the kingdom than he should have. But Mordecai was a servant of the king. He was placed in the position of servant on the behalf of the king, and he sat in the king's gate. That's why he was at the king's gate, in order to participate in this whole procedure that involves Haman here. So these men who sat in the king's gate, the servants of the king, whenever Haman came out, they did obeisance to him, and the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow, and neither did he do obeisance to him. And the king's servants who were in the king's gate said unto Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's commandment?" Now it came to pass, when he spoke daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Mordecai said, "I can't bow down to Haman, and I'm not going to do obeisance to him because I'm a Jew." But Mordecai, you're living in Persia here. I mean, don't you realize that you're living in Persia? I mean, if you're a Jew, that's wonderful. I mean, so you're a Jew. So what? Jews, they have a place, their land, it's Israel. But you're not in Israel. You're in Persia. Now, have you heard that expression, Mordechai? When you're in Persia, do as the Persians. That's probably the way it went in Persia anyway. Why didn't that apply to this guy? I mean, he was in Persia. Why was he still living and conducting his life like a Jew? Why couldn't he bow down to this king or to this representative of the king? Why couldn't he do obeisance to him? I mean, everybody else was doing it. I mean, surely if everybody else was doing it, it must be okay. I mean, because if everybody else is doing it, and of course everybody else has thought about it, I mean, everybody else has realized and has thought of the ramifications involved in bowing down to this man. And it wasn't a problem for any of these Persians. Why wasn't it a problem for Mordecai? I mean, why couldn't he bring himself to bow down to this man? And furthermore, I mean, he violated one of the king's commandments in the process. I mean, he was required to break Persian law insofar as he wouldn't comply with it and bow down to Haman. At any rate, Haman, he kind of got a little upset about this. And in spite of all of the attention that he was given, in spite of all of the attention that he was given by all of the other servants, in spite of the fact that he was elevated to a position of authority and responsibility within the kingdom, I mean, Mordecai was like a thorn in his flesh. I mean, it's like, even though the whole kingdom was bowing down to him and he had the attention of everyone, because Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him, it was like he just couldn't stand this man. Of course, that is frequently the case as well, isn't it? Of course, we don't live in Persia. We live in the United States. Except you could say that there is much about Persia that is like the United States. Of course, we're Americans here, aren't we? Just like Hadassah and everybody else, Mordecai included, in Persia, was a Persian. I mean, I hate to buck the melting pot concept, but the melting pot, I mean, it's got enough variety in it without us. Furthermore, we're told by the Lord not to be melted in the great pot. We're told by the Lord to retain our identity and distinction as believers. So, how does this apply to us? I mean, is there anything in this story that applies to us? I mean, what should our behavior and the conduct of our lives be like? Should we consider ourselves Americans or Russians or Mexicans or any other ins that exist? Or should our identity be based upon the call which God has made upon our lives? Mordecai's being in Persia didn't make him Persian, and it didn't make any of the Jews who were born in Persia Persian any more than we who are believers are American and should be doing American things because we're American, and that's just because of the way things are done here. So we should do them because that's the way they're done here, and a lot of people do them, and so it must be right to do. Now, obviously that kind of thinking is a little problem with it. I shouldn't say there's a problem with it. It depends on whether being an American and doing what Americans do or doing what Frenchmen do or doing what Germans do, particularly what Germans do, or doing what anyone does. I mean there's obviously some place where doing what people do isn't wrong. Of course, it doesn't depend upon whether it's American or German or French. It depends on what it is, huh? And when we're required to do something that is not biblically authorized, where does our responsibility lie? Does it lie to our country and to our culture, or does it lie to the Lord? Now, Hadassah was forced to make a decision, and Mordecai was forced to make a decision. And his being a minority individual in a big foreign country didn't affect or change a thing It didn't change anything. How did God require that Mordechai as a Jew live in Israel? As a Jew. And when Mordechai went to Persia, does God now permit him to live like a Persian, or does he want him to continue living like a Jew? Of course, you could ask the same question on the part of Daniel, who also continued to conduct his life as a Jew, not as a Babylonian. He continued to retain his identity as a Jew. And of course, you could say the same thing of Ezekiel. You could say the same thing of anyone who was carried away as an individual into captivity. When Nehemiah was carried away into captivity, and when Ezra was carried away into captivity, and Zerubbabel was carried away into captivity, did they embrace the culture of the countries that they went to? No, because the heart of a Jew is Jerusalem, and the Messiah is his only king. Except in the context in which we're describing things now, we're not talking only about Jews who are Jews by physical descent. We're talking about people generally who have embraced the call of God to come out. Who have embraced the call of God to come out. Because the Messiah is the king of all called out ones. Not only the king of the Jews. He's the king of all of us who are called out of the what? Of the world to believe. We have a calling upon our lives, and that calling needs to take priority over everything we think and do. Not whether we're this or whether we're that or whether we're something else. We need to evaluate what we're doing and the practices of our lives in the perspective of what we've been called to as a body of believers. In chapter 3 here, this conflict between Haman and Mordechai begins to brew. And it begins to brew and brew, and it becomes a fiery obsession of Haman to see Mordechai grovel in the dirt before him. And he ultimately becomes so possessed with his hatred, not only for Mordechai, but for the people that Mordechai represents, because apparently not only was Mordechai living and conducting his life as a Jew, but the entire people were. See what it says here? He says in verse 8, Haman said to the king, there is a certain people who is scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other people. Neither do they keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not to your profit to keep these people around. They're just troublemakers. I mean, they're troublemakers. They do things differently. I mean, therefore, they are troublemakers. They don't obey your laws. They don't bow down and worship me like they're supposed to, which really bothers me. But he says, but they're troublemakers anyway. I mean, they celebrate these screwy holidays. They keep Shabbat and are working on the Saturday like everybody else does. They don't worship the sun god on Sunday. They don't worship the birth of Mithra, the sun god, on December 25th, like everybody else in Persia worship. That's what December 25th commemorates, by the way, the birth of the Persian sun god. I mean, they don't do any of these things that we do. I mean, they're the scum of the earth. I mean, they're a cancer in our society. I mean, their only impact can be bad. I mean, because they serve to divide. You know, they serve to divide us as a nation. I mean, they're like this little group. Everybody else has assimilated into Persian culture. You know, I mean, and Haman wasn't the first one to attempt this. I mean, everybody, beginning back with Nimrod, I mean, everybody wants everybody to live as one big happy family. Of course, the one big happy family, the children of the family, aren't the children of God, generally. They're the children of the enemy. And we're called to be different. We're called to be different from the world. And this group, I mean, we got to get rid of this group. And so they devise a means of destroying that particular group. And when Mordechai heard about the mechanism that Haman had employed, the casting of the poor, or the Purim, the casting of the lots, to destroy the Jewish people. Mordechai, after he learned what was done, he tore off his clothes and he put on sackcloth and ashes, and he went into the center of the city and he cried with a loud and a bitter voice, and came before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where the king's commandment went, there was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. And Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told her what was going on. Then the queen was exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to Mordecai. She said, "Hey, Mordecai, would you, you know, this is, come on, you look terrible. You know, would you change this? I mean, aren't you going, taking this a little too far? I mean, you know, this thing has happened, and our people are in danger." And I wonder if she said, "Our people are in danger." Maybe at this point she was beginning to feel a little comfortable with where she was. I mean, we don't really know. We do know that when Mordechai addresses her later on in this chapter, and when Esther continually pleads with Mordechai to, you know, to kind of get a hold of yourself, Mordechai. I mean, you know, what's going on here? I mean, you know, you're my uncle. I'm the queen. You're embarrassing me. You know, stop crying out in the middle of the streets of the city in sackcloth and ashes. You know, I mean, I sent clothes to you. I mean, it's from Nordstrom's, you know, or some from Bullock's. Put this stuff on. It's good stuff. You know, clean yourself up. This is a disgrace. And Mordecai has to respond to her and say, "Hadassah, you remember I told you not to tell anybody who you were. But let's not take this a step too far and think that you are no longer what you are." I mean, Hadassah, we're talking about our people being destroyed here. We're talking about a commandment that has been issued in the name of the king. I mean, we're talking about the wholesale destruction of every man, woman, and child, every single Jew in each of the 127 provinces. We're talking about the whole group, Hadassah. And do you hear what I'm saying? Hadassah, Hadassah, Hadassah. I mean, Esther, don't forget that you're Hadassah. You're not Esther. Don't forget who you are. Don't think. And this is where her conflict really brews. In verse 13, "Think not within yourself that you shall escape in the king's house more so than any of the other Jews. For if you altogether hold your peace at this time, then there shall relief and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house shall be destroyed." Now, not only would she be destroyed, but her father's house would be destroyed. And it's important that the house of a family live on. Why? Why is it so important for the name of a family to live on? Because of the inheritance. Because even though they're Jews living in Persia, they don't intend to live in Persia forever. They're familiar with the words and the prophecies that describe their being called back to the land and the hope of Israel as a people to possess a land. He says, "But you and your father's house shall be destroyed." And then he says, "And who knows whether you are come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" I mean, this is a remarkable statement. You know, I mean, this is as good as any Jewish mother could do at this point. Hadassah, don't think that you're going to escape. Maybe she thought that she would escape. Why would she want to escape? Why would she want to escape when her entire people would be destroyed? Or the Jewish people as a people, at least in Persia and those 127 provinces, from India to Ethiopia. That's a lot of people. They were all about to be destroyed, but she was the queen. She was Queen Esther. She wasn't Queen Hadassah. She was Queen Esther. I mean, she was named after the goddess of beauty, the goddess of fertility. Would she escape the judgment coming? I mean, she wasn't going to tell anybody, was she? She wasn't going to tell anybody that she was Jewish. Mordechai told her not to. So how was someone going to find out? I mean, she obviously didn't have the kind of nose I had, or she couldn't have won any contest with it. It wasn't that funny. How was someone going to know? Yeah, how could she watch? Yeah, Mordechai knew that. How, number one, could she watch her people being killed? How did Adolf Hitler discover who all the Jews were? You know, in Germany, the Jews of Germany and the Jews of Russia and the Jews of France and the Jews throughout Europe, you know, for the most part, for many of them, they had assimilated into German culture and into Russian culture and into French culture. And you know, the French Jews, you know what they thought? They were French. And the German Jews, you know, they considered themselves German. And you know, the Russian Jews, they considered themselves Russian. And the American Jews, they considered themselves American. But how did the Russians perceive the Russian Jews? As Russian? As Jews. And the German people perceived the German Jews as Jews. And the French Jews perceived the French Jews as Jews, not French. And in America, Americans will perceive American Jews, not as Americans, but as Jews. Of course, when that time comes, there'll be another group that is linked to the Jews. And the conflict won't only be a conflict which embraces the Jewish people as a people, which I must admit will undoubtedly take place first, but there'll be another group that is called to identify themselves, either with God's people as a people or with Americanism as Americans. And Yeshua in Matthew chapter 25 seems to indicate that that will be the criteria by which the nations are judged in the last days. Faith will be determined then, as it is frequently determined now, by the degree to which we perceive ourselves as a believer or as an American, as a believer or as a Russian, as a believer or as a Scandinavian or any other kind of ethnic group. We're supposed to perceive ourselves as believers. Of course, you know, I'd be kind of irresponsible in my duty if I also didn't raise this one last issue that has to do with the decision that Esther ultimately made. I mean, she ultimately made a decision to be counted as a part of God's people. Of course, the impeccable logic that brought her to that conclusion is a conclusion that we should evaluate. It's a conclusion which is also evaluated in many passages of Scripture. I'd like, if you would, to turn to John chapter 6. It's a decision that was evaluated by Abraham, was it not? When Abraham was called by the Lord to go to another country, what did Abraham do? What did Abraham do when he was called by God to go to a land that he had never, ever seen before? He obeyed God and he went. He obeyed God, and he went. And what did Abraham do when he was called by God to sacrifice Isaac? He obeyed God, and he went. He obeyed God, and he went. In John chapter 6, we have the account of the feeding of the multitude. The feeding of the 5,000, Yeshua walking on the water. Yeshua describing himself as the bread of life. And then the discourse in chapter 6 having to do with the fact that he is the bread of God. The address that takes place here in chapter 6, because of the fact that the people followed Yeshua, not because they believed that he was the Son of God, but because he fed them. You know, he fed them. And in verse 26, he says, "Truly, truly, you seek me, not because you saw miracles, but because you ate the loaves and were filled. You weren't convinced that I am the Son of God because of the miracles I performed." He says in verse 53, "Except you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day." Obviously, Jesus wasn't talking about, you know, his body being quartered at his crucifixion and being passed out for people to eat on. But he was talking about something which goes way beyond, saying, "Lord, I'm a sinner. I open the door of my heart unto you. Come in, Lord Jesus. Amen." I mean, that's a nice first step. Don't get me wrong. That's a nice first step. But Yeshua is talking about the kind of commitment to him that requires feasting on him and chewing on him. You know, when you break bread together in Hebrew thinking, when you share something together, I mean, it's like you become a part of it. You know, when you eat of the flesh of Yeshua and when you drink his blood, it's like you embrace him with everything that you are and you become what he is and become like he is. He says, "My flesh is food, my blood is drink. He that eats my flesh and drinks my blood dwells in me and I in him. As the living Father has sent me and I live by the Father, so he that eats me shall live by me. This is the bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers ate manna and are dead. This is the bread that you might eat of which can cause you to live forever." These things he taught in the synagogue at Capernaum or Capernaum. Many, therefore, of his disciples, when they heard this, they said, "This is a hard saying. Who can hear it?" This is incredible. I mean, we're being asked to pay everything for this. I mean, we're talking about a dramatic cost here. We're not talking about following this man around the Sea of Galilee and watching all of our sick people healed and watch everybody jump to their feet and rejoice and dance. I mean, we're not talking about a party here. We're talking about the kind of commitment which is ultimately going to lead to the kind of strife and conflict that Yeshua experienced. I mean, this man is promising us, in effect, the same thing that happened to him. I mean, that's terrific. You know, jump on the bandwagon. Pick up your Cadillac and follow me. I mean, drag your cross to the end of the rainbow and you'll find your pot of gold there. Except, it hurts to be nailed to a cross. And it hurts to be persecuted. And it hurts to have to experience what he did. Except that's what he promised. He goes on to say, and this is important, "When Jesus knew in himself that his disciples murmured at this, he says, 'Does this offend you?' He says, 'What if you shall see the Son of Man ascend up where he was before? If the Spirit that gives life the flesh profits nothing, the words that I speak to you, they are spirit and they are life. But there are some of you that do not believe. For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were who believed not and who should betray him.'" And then he says, "Therefore did I say unto you that no man can come to me except it were given unto him by my Father." From that time, in verse 66, many of his disciples went back and walk no more with them. In verse 67, Jesus asks the question, will you go to? Will you go to? That's the question that Esther had to wrestle with. Will you go to, Esther? Will you turn away from your people? Will you turn back from following the Lord? That's a question which we need to ask ourselves. That's a question which, in all fairness, has to be asked of people who have a desire to make a commitment to the Lord. They have to be encouraged to count the cost of the decision that they're making, because there will come a time when they will wonder within their own heart, will I too turn away? Except what's beautiful about the decision that Esther made, and what's beautiful about the decision that Peter made, and that Peter expressed on behalf of the disciples, was, Lord, where else can we go? Where else can you go with that conflict that you're facing, with the decision that you have to make, with the decision that you'll need to make in 2 weeks or 2 years? Where can you go? Where can you go? You know, serving the Lord is a wonderful thing. We should rejoice in serving Him. We can rejoice in praising Him for the goodness, praising Him for the blessings that He brings into our lives. But you know, Esther's decision to walk in before the king and to risk her very life and limb was based upon the knowledge that she was a dead woman either way. If she went in before the king and was not received, she would have been executed. And if she didn't go in before the king, she was sure to be executed. If we don't come to faith in Yeshua, we are sure to be executed. I mean, it is a sure thing. Let no man mock God. The judgment that He says is coming, it will come. And the conflict that we face, it does come. And the joyful times, the times of joy, and the times of glory, they come too. Except, you know, there are times when we have to just decide when we're facing conflict and when we're facing a difficult situation. I mean, who else can we turn to? I don't know why we should want to turn to anybody else, but sometimes that's what we allow our emotions to do with us. Can you imagine serving anybody but God? I mean, it's crazy. It is. It's nuts. You have to be nuts not to want to serve the Lord. And yet, when difficulty comes up, I mean, it's like, boom, try everything else first, you know? I mean, it's like, who else can you turn to? I mean, you've experienced the presence of God. You've experienced the glory of God. You've experienced His touch. Some of you have experienced His speaking to you. You felt His touch. You felt His peace. You felt forgiven of your sins. Why would we be willing to trade that for anything? And where else could you get it? You can't. I mean, there is nowhere else to get it. What kind of dilemma did Esther face? You know? There were also people who didn't and don't even today make that decision. There are people who don't come to the conclusion that she reached and don't come to the conclusion that Peter reached. What about those who turned away from the Lord? Where did they go? Where did they go? They left Yeshua. Where did they go? Yeah, they went to nothing. They left everything for nothing. They left absolutely everything for nothing. Fight. Fight the feelings that well up within you that God doesn't love you, that God doesn't care about you, that God doesn't see me, that God doesn't feel what I feel, that God doesn't hurt with my hurt. Fight those feelings with everything you've got. Because God does love you. He does care about you. He does intend to accomplish His work and His purpose in your life. He does intend to express His love and His mercy and His grace to you. But there is nowhere else to go anyway. There is nowhere else to go anyway. And of course, we see here in the book of Esther how gloriously God did fulfill His purpose. And God used this one woman to affect the course of human history. Is it possible that He intends to use you to affect the course of human history? Now, this is a question which you've heard before. It always comes out of a study in the book of Esther. Perhaps you are here at this very moment for something. That's ridiculous. That's crazy, isn't it? I mean, God used Esther, and God used Jonah, and God used Abraham, and God used all kinds of people. Except for some reason, it doesn't count. It doesn't work in the 20th century with me. Perhaps you are here this morning. Perhaps you're a part of the body of Adat Mashiach for some work. And I'm going to say this anyway, even though we don't typically believe this, that only you can do. No one else, not a single person alive at Esther's time, could do what she did. And I just have to ask this one final question. Was it because of Esther? That's maybe not a fair question, because in some ways it was. And in some ways it had nothing to do with Esther, didn't it? It had to do with what? It had to do with the position she was in. It had to do with the position she was in. I mean, if Esther wasn't the queen, could she have gone in before the king and said, "Hey, king, I mean, I think there's a big mistake happening here. I mean, you know, this people that are going to get destroyed, I'm going to get destroyed with them. You don't want that, do you?" I mean, if Esther wasn't the queen, hey, that wouldn't have been a concern of the king at all. There were two things going for Esther. She was a believer who was called to be a believer and who knew that she had a responsibility to her people, and she was in a position to effect change.
For additional copies of this tape or information on other tapes that would minister to you and your friends, write to Firefighters for Christ at the address on the back side of this tape.